muy buenas tardes o días, donde se encuentren todos conectándose. Bienvenidos a todas y todos a esta 58 jornada de la Relate, que pues tiene un tema de vanguardia que siempre buscamos para ustedes, pero es algo muy especial porque tenemos un ponente de Estados Unidos que nos va a compartir su experiencia. Mi nombre es Pedro Rocha, que organizo y coordino el Comité Multimodal y de Transformación Digital Educativa de la RELATE. Y nuestro tema del día de hoy, de este mes, es que nos vamos a reflexionar. Siempre estamos en buscando las nuevas tendencias, pues tendencias y retos de la educación en línea. Y hoy tenemos un invitado que les platico cómo llegamos a esta oportunidad que me parece importante para todos. En la pasada conferencia de ANUYES anual que tuvimos en San Luis Potosí, pues tuve el gusto de reencontrarme con una compañera y amiga, Karina Catalán, que pues me acercó a CERTA y la plática fue muy dinámica, buscando pues compartir las experiencias. Les agradezco a CERTA y a Canvas que hayan tomado la invitación, que la hayamos podido conformar y poder haber llegado pues a su invitado especial, que Ryan Lupton. Welcome to this space, Ryan. I introduce very fast and start to speaking. Él es vicepresidente de estrategia global de Instruct, los creadores de Canvas, el LMS que muchos de nosotros conocemos. Es muy entusiasta en la tecnología educativa, tiene 20 o más años de trayectoria trabajando en empresas líderes en desarrollo de soluciones de software que impacten positivamente en las vidas de los profesores y alumnos, que sabemos pues, que son nuestros actores, nuestros destinatarios del trabajo que hacemos todos nosotros. Él ha dictado conferencias, ha escrito varios artículos de estas nuevas tendencias de la tecnología educativa. Por mencionar algunos foros que él ha participado en Forbes, University Business y Campus News y Test Magazine. Ryan es licenciado en Ciencias de la Comunicación y Relaciones Públicas en la Universidad de Utah y cuenta con un posgrado en Dirección de Empresas en el Cornell Johnson y con certificación en Marketing de Base de Datos. Vamos a pedirles a ustedes, y tenemos un traductor porque Ryan es de lengua inglesa y nos va a compartir su experiencia. Yo les pediría a quienes puedan escucharlo en inglés, pues en inglés abajo en la pantallita tenemos interpretación. Por favor, seleccionen su idioma. Si lo queremos escuchar en español, tenemos un traductor, el cual le agradezco a Eleazar que esté con nosotros, para que podamos entender y también ser el vínculo de los comentarios, preguntas que tengamos al respecto. Entonces, a todos ustedes, por favor, elijan su idioma, de preferencia uno de ellos, o si se quieren quedar en este espacio, pues escucharán, pero creo que ambos. Ryan, welcome again to start with your conference.
Thank you, Dr. Roca. Appreciate your introduction.
Hola a todos. En nombre de Acerta y de Instructur, los creadores de Canvas LMS, les doy la bienvenida al webinar sobre tendencias y retos de la educación en línea. ¿Alguien de aquí alguna vez ha tenido miedo de adaptarse a algo nuevo? Yo sí. Me aterra hablar en público, pero lo estoy superando. Es muy común sentirnos abrumados ante lo desconocido, y aunque la tecnología nos ofrece infinitas herramientas, a veces puede resultar desafiante. Aprender a utilizar recursos como la IA generativa, la realidad virtual o la analítica de datos es un reto al que educadores y líderes de instituciones educativas se enfrentan todos los días. Hoy, gracias al equipo de CUDI que nos ha permitido conectarnos con ustedes, tenemos la oportunidad de compartirles la visión de Ryan Lufkin, vicepresidente de Estrategia Académica Global de Instructur, sobre las 8 tendencias que impactarán el futuro de la educación. Ryan es un entusiasta de la tecnología educativa, con más de 20 años de trayectoria como profesor y ejecutivo de empresas líderes en desarrollo de soluciones EdTech. En los últimos años, se ha dedicado a investigar sobre tendencias emergentes y a impulsar la innovación como parte de su compromiso con el progreso de la educación. Les dejo con Ryan, o como a él le gusta que lo presentemos, el leñador de la tecnología educativa.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Go ahead and share my screen here. Excellent. So I appreciate that introduction. That actually is a great example of one of the emerging trends that we'll be talking about here, generative AI and some of the benefits and potential dangers of AI, not even mentioning some of the technical issues that we can sometimes have. But let me introduce myself again. I appreciate the intro moving forward. If you're not familiar with Instructure, we are the makers of Canvas LMS, the learning management system. We were really the first cloud-based SaaS learning management system available in the market. We're the largest, most widely used in North America and growing rapidly worldwide. And so not to focus on that too much, but my background has been over the last 20 years in education, starting in 1999. At a company called Campus Pipeline, which started that transformation of education by providing just a simple HTML portal to a very clunky backend student information system. And then my career throughout has been really working for different aspects of educational technology. So from SunGard, the makers of Banner SIS, to Allen Communication, learning to build curriculum for training at both corporations and universities. Ellucian, which was the result of the merger of SunGard and Datatel, working with them to launch their mobile applications, their student success and student advising tools, things like that. And then to Canvas, where I've been here for 6 years. Or Instructure. I truly love the company. I love our mission. It's something that I'm excited about. I'm lucky enough in my role to get to travel around the world, everywhere from Australia to the Philippines, Colombia, Barcelona, and talk about the trends in education. And so I get as much from the conversations that I have with you, the educators, with you, the administrators, as I do in sharing this information. So I'm going to leave some time here at the end for questions, and hopefully we make this more of a conversation towards the end. Lo siento, mi español es no muy bueno, so I'm coming to you in English, but I am attempting to improve my Spanish, so maybe in the future I'll present to you fully in Spanish. One of the things I want to talk about is a podcast that Melissa Lobel, who is our chief academic officer, and I host. I'll share a little more information on that later, but it's one of the avenues where we bring together a lot of educational leaders, much like this event, and talk about emerging trends and really get into the very specific categories. But I want to talk about the future of education. That's why we're all here. And I think we really have been through the most transformative time in the history of education since 2020. I think COVID really kicked off a transformational aspect of you know, technology enhanced learning that we will now build off of into the future, and AI is one of the topics we'll talk about, and it really does, it has kind of sucked all of the air out of the room. Every conference you go to is very heavily talking about AI, but it's not the only trend, and I want to make sure we put that into context a little bit. These are the impactful eight, as we call them, and these are the eight trends that we really do think are going to be most impactful over the course of the next 2, 5, 10 years. So operational efficiency and effectiveness. We launched a lot of solutions during COVID. Now it's how do we measure those? Assessment lifecycle. Really, how do we change the way we're assessing? And you'll see a little bit how these are all interrelated. Data decisions and design. Really, data everything. How do we make sure that we're getting access to the underlying data to make decisions at every level? Education and industry partnerships. We'll talk a little bit more about what that looks like, but we see this more and more across the globe as we attempt to close the skills gap between what we're teaching and what employers need. Lifelong learning, really, you're moving from a kind of siloed primary school. In the U.S., we'd call it K-12, in college, traditional undergraduate enrollment, and then employment. And so we're seeing much more of a lifelong learning journey. And we'll talk a little bit more about the depths of that. AI, of course, I promise we'd talk about that. But then pathing, tracking, and demonstrating that learning for potential employers is key. And then the future of learning, just in general, what does that look like? Now, what's interesting is these are all interrelated. They are a Venn diagram. And so as we talk about these, please realize that there's overlap. We are attempting to create things, kind of silo and categorize things that in many cases defy those classifications. But if we try to do an eight circle Venn diagram, it looks more like a flower. It gets very convoluted. So we're not going to go down that path, but please understand that these are all interrelated as we talk about them. So the first of our impactful eight is operational efficiency and effectiveness. And one of the challenges we faced is, you know, we look at the number of softwares that are introduced across campuses. It can be very difficult to measure what are actually being used, what are actually being leveraged by the majority of educators. And so there's been a huge trend globally in really reviewing, you know, as we moved in March of 2020 from an online experience to a fully online experience, on-campus experience to an online experience, we implemented a lot of technologies for stopgap. And now we need to actually look at those technologies and really understand how do we optimize what we're paying for them, what is working, what's most effective. And that's leading to what we call a great consolidation, I think. We need to make sure we're measuring all those aspects. What's interesting is, as I traveled in the Philippines, for instance, had a mandate to return to on-campus learning. And a lot of their educators took that very much as now that we are back in the classroom, we don't need technology anymore. And so we spent a lot of time actually trying to educate them on the fact that technology enhanced learning is the new normal. You should be teaching out of your LMS, whether that's Canvas or otherwise, both in the classroom and if there was a need for some sort of disruption, if there was a need to go fully online. And what that does is actually two things. One, students are digitally native. Many students, even in developing nations, are more likely to have a smartphone than a computer. They're more likely to, you know, get most of their information from that smartphone. So we need to make sure we're meeting students where they are and delivering technologies in a way that are actually having an impact and engaging those students. And so at the front end, that engagement is really important. But as we move forward, you know, the potential for disruption, we're seeing global climate change very much affecting, you know, our weather patterns. The, you know, COVID has not gone away. So, you know, even things to student mental health. I talk about my kids a lot. I have a 19-year-old daughter who is a freshman at the University of Utah, here in Utah, where I live. My son is in junior high school. And so I watch them use the technologies in a way. And I see, you know, my son has friends that are struggling with depression and other mental health issues. And because their courses are taught in Canvas, those students are able to miss days of school when they just can't motivate to go and not fall behind their coursework. And that's really important, making sure that we've got that technology in place. And so we used to spend a lot of time categorizing the types of teaching as, you know, on campus, high flex, hybrid, and fully online, things like that. And I think what we've moved towards is more of a broad definition of technology enhanced learning, technology. We're actually trying to figure out what we want to call this, but is it technology amplified learning, technology, you know, moderated learning, whatever that is? It's using technology to reach every student in ways that supports them, whatever their needs are. And so understanding how those technologies are being used, making sure they're being effective, and that's twofold, right? Our educators are adopting them to the level that you as an organization need them to adopt them, right? And we need to make sure that we're looking across the board at the EdTech ecosystem that we've created and finding those efficiencies. The next of our impactful eight is the assessment life cycle, from skills to success. And this is a really interesting, because I think from assessment at different levels, whether it's the primary education level or the secondary education level, assessment means different things, right? And we've moved more from, in many countries, we've moved more from a traditional grade-based model to where students are competing with each other to a competency-based model, right? A mastery-based model where we're measuring students' mastery of a skill. And it's a much more equitable approach to teaching and learning, because ultimately what we need to make sure is that they're mastering those skills. We need every student to master those skills, not just the top students within the class. And so how do we assess that? And so you're seeing a lot more formative assessment throughout the process, and less high stakes summative assessments that measure your ability to move on to the next phase of education. We're also seeing things like the CBE or competency-based education movement, where we go in and measure a student's prior knowledge of a skill, and then we map the personalization of that education towards mastery of that knowledge, right? Competency of that knowledge. And then once they have that, we need to make sure we give them proof that they've mastered that skill. We'll talk about that a little bit as we get to another one of these categories. But what's so important, and I think now as we move towards this new assessment model, we've also seen AI thrown into the mix. And I promise this was going to be a Venn diagram. But what AI has done is really thrown a wrench in our traditional assessment models. It's much more difficult now to give a student an assignment to create a 20-page paper and not expect them to use AI to do that. And so how do we measure skill in ways that don't require us to go back to pencil and paper, allow us to still use the technology to measure those competencies, but help them do it in a way? And so assessment's a little bit turned on its head. We need to move beyond the idea that AI is just a cheating tool. We need to make sure we're understanding how it can be used as part of this process. Because when you look at things like that competency-based education model, AI provides a lot of opportunity for us to personalize that learning journey specifically to the student, because it understands the student, it's learning from what they're doing, how they're succeeding, where they're falling down and need additional help. And so we can really create personalized learning models that we couldn't have dreamed of doing manually before. So how do we make sure that moving forward, we leverage these tools in really powerful ways? But ultimately, the moving away from the traditional assessment model, moving towards a much more skills-based model is incredibly important. And those aren't just we get into this conversation a little bit in some countries where breaking down the skills, you may have a course in accounting, right? The skill isn't just accounting. The skill may be record keeping, usage of a software, the ability to interact with third parties, to pull data sets together, things like that. Those are all skills. And sometimes those skills were considered soft skills, like communication, like the ability to present, right? These aren't soft skills. These are important skills that we need. So we need to make sure they're not lost as part of this evolution of the assessment model, but we need to make sure we're measuring them as their own distinct elements, right? Compassion, evidence-based decision-making. These are all things that make us better as a society. How do we make sure that we don't lose those as well? Third one is data decisions and design. I think this is a multi-layered story. And so one of the things that I think is interesting is we talk a lot about using data to understand, across an entire organization, how we're doing, how are the systems being used, that kind of thing. But there's program level, there's student level, there's, individual course level data. And all of those data sets have to roll up to some coherent approach, right? With the LMS, what we see a lot is, the LMS is your digital classroom, but you very well may be using LTI applications to provide video conferencing, to provide different aspects of quizzing, to provide math homework, to provide different content, right? All of these are different software tools that to come together seamlessly for the student, but they are creating their own data sets. And so behind the scenes, we as administrators are left with more data sets to try to make sense of. And we went through the big data days. I use the finger quotes for big data because that was quite the talking point 5 to 10 years ago. How do we bring all these data pieces together? And what we found was a lot of organizations spent a lot of time pulling data together into a data lake or a data repository to then not really understand how to move forward with that? How do you synchronize that, right? And so what we're seeing is making data available at a lot different levels, right? So making course data available to the educator, but maybe also the student. The students, students have grown up with video games. They're used to having access to their performance data directly in a video game. They can see how they did and then why they want to improve on that. So there's a movement to even expose some of that data towards a student. There's even regulation in Europe that students have a right to that data, to be able to see that data and what data they're producing. And so we need to make sure that we're addressing that. But then how do we optimize courses? How do we use the data within a course to understand what's working well and what's not, and how do we improve that? That's powerful for educators. And 5 to 10 years ago, educators would have pushed back on that and said, hey, that's Big Brother, you're monitoring me. But now they understand that, I think one of the lessons from COVID was when you don't have students sitting directly in front of you and you can't read their body language and you can't see how engaged they are, you really have to look at data and look at the data to see how engaged they are and how they're doing. That has come together now to a much more openness towards using that data to improve student engagement, but to improve the courses as well. That rolls up the programs. How are students doing as they move through this program? Are they being successful? And then ultimately to an organization. So using the data at all of those levels is so incredibly important, and understanding the model, the approach that you want to use, so that you don't just dump all of your data into a lake and say, we got the data. You've got to be able to have a model for how you're going to leverage that data to improve education, to improve student outcomes, to improve educator workload and educator effectiveness, that kind of thing. So it's a huge model, and I think it's an evolving. We've talked about data for years. We've moved beyond that big data conversation, and I really think that this use of data holistically to help students and educators and institutions really is one of the major conversations that's happening out there right now. Education and industry partnerships. This is one that it's definitely a Venn diagram, and we're going to talk a little bit about some of the other aspects that kind of overlap here. What's interesting is we're seeing a lot of employers basically say, look, we've got a skills gap. We're not getting the students that we need with the skills that we need to be able to, to be immediately effective with their job. So we're hiring students with a degree, and yet they don't know how to do the things that we need them to do. So then we have to train them ourselves, right? And so this has led to a lot of partnerships. There's Utah State University here in Utah, where I am, works directly with Lockheed Martin. Literally, they've got an associate's 2-year degree in rocketry, I think is the term. And these students are moving directly into very well-paying jobs with a 2-year degree because they understand immediately how to work on those. And it's because the university and the organization came together to really define those skills. That's really compelling, except it's much more difficult to do that at scale. We see that a lot with one-on-one. Arizona State University works with Uber or Starbucks. Memphis or University of Memphis here in the States works with FedEx, right? I was just in Australia, and we see them working with Australia employers the same way. The Philippines, they're working a lot more with experiential learning, and how do we put these meld a traditional degree with experience-based learning where they're actually almost an apprenticeship as they move into a job, right? Those pathways. It's being much more flexible than we've seen in the past. And I think what you see, the data point here on the right of the screen, shows those non-degree programs are really exploding. I've done a couple of certificate programs myself. I think it's one of those aspects of, and when we talk about lifelong learning, we'll talk a little bit more about that. But this idea that we need to make sure we're aligning student outcomes to employability has really been difficult, I think, for higher education to come to terms with in some instances, but that is really the predominant reason that students are going to the college or university, is to find those jobs, to find paths to well-paying jobs. So how do we actually help partner and even build, broadly accepted skills taxonomies so that we are all understanding that these are the skills that we need. Let's break down our courses to map to those skills, and let's make sure those skills evolve as the needs of employers evolve. And that's something that we work with organizations like One EdTech here in the United States that developed the LTI standard. They're developing their, you know, the open credentials standard, things like that, because we need to make sure that we're meeting those needs of those employers and doing it at scale, not just with the largest or the most well-funded organizations. The lifelong learning journey. And this is one that I've spent a lot of time on because I think it's incredibly compelling. I think, you know, years ago, we would come out, we work for one employer for most of our career. And nowadays, the average career span is much shorter globally. We see this, you know, really mapped to all regions. Students will come out, work for a company for really 3 to 5 years being the average, and then move on to another job. It's no longer those 30 years. And that requires us to move to a much different model, right? We've always been very much focused on this idea that students that go to primary education, primary school, K-12, whatever terminology you want to use for it, move directly into college or move out into the workplace, right? And what we're finding now is there's so many different paths. You know, that traditional approach on the left really is very linear. And now we're seeing it's much more of a loop with you know, adult learners needing to come back for reskilling and upskilling, you know, really showing building proof of credentials. Different countries have different rates of dropout, right? Not every student that enters a two-year or a four-year degree program is actually able to complete that degree. Somewhere between 30% and 60% in some cases don't finish their degree. So how do we make it easier to re-engage with those students and make sure they come back to finish those? I've done a lot of work with the Stanford Center on Longevity, and Stanford University spawned this because they said, look, we're living to be older. Pretty soon in most developing countries, we're gonna be living to nearly 100 years old. What does that mean for education, for finance, for healthcare, for all of those aspects? And so as we talk about it, people are going to be having multiple changes in degrees, even encore careers. And how do we make sure that they can always come back to our institutions to re-engage with that? And that, you know, the previous slide where I showed that large increase in non-traditional programs, that's really stemmed from this approach. And I think we're seeing more and more of that. One aspect of that too, that I think is we've been talking about recently, is this idea that we've in the past treated our on-campus programs and our online programs very, very differently. And what we're seeing a lot with this is they really need to not be treated very differently, right? You should be using the same LMS, the same technology for those students. You should be finding similar paths, finding similar courses, even having multimodal delivery of courses, right? But the idea is that these are not so different anymore. They're not adult learner versus young learner, traditional learner versus non-traditional. They're one learner. Right. And we need to start treating them that way to make sure that we are pulling them into the past and actually optimizing the resources that the university has. In a lot of instances, standing them up as separate organizations just doesn't make a lot of sense. And so making sure we're streamlining those. So that idea that we're going to be learning throughout our life cycle, it's good for all of us. You know, there's a great video I watched yesterday from an educator. And she said, I did not think I was good enough at math. So I went and took a certificate program on teaching math. And she said it opened my eyes to the fact that I was actually good at math. I no longer needed to only teach kindergarten, right? Entry-level students. I was able to actually go up and teach at the high school level, at the college level, because I was good at math. And she had the skills. That training opened that door for her and made sure she was confident with going to apply for those additional jobs. We see that every day. People have the skills, they have the ability, they may not have the confidence. And simply taking courses, individual courses, multi-course credential programs, boot camps, they can open the door for so much for these students at every level. And so I think that's why you're seeing, you know, like in the Philippines, there's a government mandate to develop more credentials programs, more certificate programs, right? To help students that may not necessarily need a 2 or 4 year degree move directly into highly technical jobs. And so that's something that their universities are attempting to deliver more of. And following the model of Google, right? We saw Google releasing certificate programs as well, to and saying, hey, we no longer require a bachelor's degree. In fact, they've stepped that back a little bit. In most cases, most jobs still require a bachelor's degree or some sort of degree, but those certificates can open a lot of doors for students, especially as they return through this process. The pathing, tracking, demonstrating learning, this is something that you'll hear us talking about in different ways. Credentials, we spend a lot of time basically saying, you know, we talked about that assessment aspect earlier. How do we show proof of learning? How do we make sure that students that are developing these skills are actually to be able to demonstrate those skills to potential employers? And there's a lot of different ways. You know, traditionally, the currency has been a degree. That's how it is. And unfortunately, sometimes a student may enter a four-year degree program and stay for 3 years and leave before they graduate with literally nothing to show for it. And so, you know, that's in the U.S., one of the things that we ran into was the student debt crisis, right? A lot of students fell into that pattern, borrowed money to go to school, and then left without a degree and did nothing to show for it. And so they weren't able to get a well-paying job to offset that. We want to break that model, right? And so what we think is a lot of schools are moving towards this. Arizona State University is one where how do we make sure as students learn these skills throughout that process, they're getting proof, solid proof credentials that let them say, hey, I only finished 2 years of school, but here's the skills I developed. Here's the skills that I can bring to your organization. And so we're seeing a lot more of that breaking down of the traditional four-year program into incremental credit. And that's super valuable for a student, but it also makes it compelling for the organization, the university, as students say, hey, I want to come back. I got this far down that path. I need these other pieces. I'm going to step back in and finish those, right? It's more transparent. It's more easily to communicate to students. Students don't feel like they're being, these credits don't, we won't transfer. We're not going to take those because now they're set in stone. I really understood the skills. And for organizations, for colleges and universities, if a course is broken down to its individual skill components here at University A, and I'm transferring to University B, it's not easier to look at that course and say, oh, this actually does map very evenly to this course. We'll give you credit for it. So it's much more equitable for students as well. And that's something that we talk a lot about with universities because nobody wants to feel like they're being cheated or they're being charged and not getting credit for that learning. But what you see too is pathways. You know, students want to understand what are the different options? What are the different pathways for me to move from entering my education to securing that education and finding a well-paying job. So you're seeing a lot more of that. And you'll hear us talk about the comprehensive learner record. This is where we're moving. Over the last, I didn't show the slide that shows the acquisitions that Instructure has made over the last 8 years, but we bought a company called Portfolium that does e-portfolios and pathways, as well as it's beyond an e-portfolio. It really is more like a profile page that allows them to demonstrate and showcase their proof of skills. And then we bought a company called Concentric Sky that makes Badger, that many of you may be familiar with, which is an open badging tool. And then we most recently bought Parchment. And Parchment is a network of that verifies credentials between primary high schools and colleges, as students are applying for college, they actually certify those skills. So I actually watched my daughter go from her high school to where she was using Canvas to the University of Utah, where she also uses Canvas, but they use Parchment to send off and apply for the different institutions, the five or six colleges that she applied to. She used Parchment for all of that. And so there's that idea that, you know, with badges, these badges we often call self-verifiable credentials, where a badge carries with it metadata that says, this is who issued it. This is what the skill was for. This is how you do it. But that badge can travel wherever it wants. And it has that data with it. But there's a higher level of verification necessary for things like degrees. And we call those verifiable credentials. And so you've got Parchment that manages that verifiable credential layer. And then you have, Canvas credentials that manages the self-verifying credentials layer. And so as those pieces all come together, the goal really is to develop a tool that from the first day of school to that last day of work, students can pull all of their proof of achievement and proof of skill mastery into a single wallet, backpack, passport, whatever we want to call it, and be able to demonstrate that, showcase that, curate that for potential employers, for additional educational institutions they want to take learning from. And so that comprehensive learning record really is where we're headed. Very student-centered. They have control over all those resources. And that's where we want to go in the future. And so you'll see a lot more conversation about that. And again, this is something that is kind of the holy grail. You'll sometimes hear it referred to as the learning and education record, LER. CLR is the alternate. But this goal that there's somehow a way to capture more than just your traditional degrees. You can capture co-curricular activity, military service, self-identified skills, things like that, in a way that's much more holistic and much more trustworthy, because there's data behind all of that. Right now, what we see is people, the level of fraud in LinkedIn and even through resumes can be very high. And with proof of skill underlying that, you eliminate a lot of that concern. Generative AI. Melissa Lobel, who's our chief academic officer, and I have a joke on our podcast that we can't have a single podcast where we don't talk about AI, because it is so prolific. And the biggest challenge, as I mentioned earlier, really is moving beyond this idea that AI is just a cheating tool, right? We're beyond that. And at some point in the future, AI tools will be so prolific that they're just, they every little manual task that you have within a software, it will automatically be taken care of, right? There are things, you know, there's kind of two aspects that we look at. One is saving educators time. How do we make sure that we automate those little tasks, right? Everything from quiz creation, right? If your large language model understands the course that you're teaching, it can automatically generate quizzes for you. Now, when I say automatically generate those quizzes for you, I want to make sure we're talking about human in the loop AI. It's really important. We don't trust AI to do anything on its own. There's always a human that approves the outcome, right? Because if you've played with AI, you understand its shortcomings and its limitations, right? As much as it is the powerful piece, right? The Titan partner research from the end of last year that I have highlighted here, they really did find that educators that are out actually playing with AI tools had a much more positive view of how it could affect students than educators who did not. And I think because as you play with these tools, you understand what they're capable of. The interesting piece that this diagram at the bottom of the slide is really important, because that's that kind of traditional adoption curve. And what you see is that most students are much further down that adoption curve than educators. And the problem that brings up is that there's a level of distrust, there's a level of misuse that's going on, because the two sides aren't coming together. And it's interesting. It seems very, you know, again, talking about my kids, but, you know, my daughter, who's now in the university, is being told when to use AI, when is it appropriate to use AI. If you're using it a paper, it's great for getting some ideas on paper. It's great for summarizing large topics. It's great for helping create outlines. You should not be using it to develop final text, things like that, right? But by acknowledging it and building into the process, they're building boundaries, guardrails around it. And what I see with my son, who's in junior high, is that his educators aren't talking to him at all about it, right? And he's kind of left to fare on himself. And so he truly, because he's tech native, he doesn't understand why, you know, ChatGPT is bad, but Grammarly is good, or some of the other tools they could have are good. Copilot, right, is good. He's not being told. And so I think there's a level of training at every level, for educators, for students, that has to take place for us to move into a much more proactive phase. So going back to the two sides, saving educators times by taking those little tasks and automating so many of those tasks, even first pass at grading, right? If you've got a rubric that measures your grading criteria, very simple task for an AI tool to look at an assignment and say, oh, yep, it hits all these points, even highlight where those points are, and then let the educator come in and say, yep, great, right? Just like a teaching assistant, right? View it as a teaching assistant, a simple automator, less as a robot that's going to take your job, and that it really does open so many doors that way. on the other side of it is the possibility to use it for student success, right? As a tutor, as a coach, as a, you know, a way to, you know, connect with your teacher when your teacher's not available on the weekends and the evenings. These are all incredibly important. And we're seeing tools roll out that kind of fill all of these needs. And so the first step is, let's gain acceptance from our educators. Let's make sure that they have tried the tools and understand what they're capable of and what they're not, because they're evolving quickly. I have a slide in another presentation where I talk about some of the challenges. And I think one of the things that is really the deep fake video and some of those aspects really are progressing at a somewhat scary rate. And so even teaching students to be skeptical of AI, we can only do if we understand what they're capable of, right? So as educators, as administrators, we need to make sure we're addressing it. And the other flower in my presentation here on the right really does outline some of those opportunities, challenges, priorities, and barriers. And I like to share that, even though it's a bit of an eye chart, very small, because I think it's very compelling to understand those opportunities and see it as a balanced tool. And then the last piece is the future of learning, right? And I think we're looking much more at the science of learning in this aspect, right? The brain science behind how we learn, how we develop skills. And there, you know, this is a broad category. We can talk about meta. We can talk about VR and AR. I'm personally on the older side. So I remember a tool called Second Life that came out in the 1990s, which was kind of, you had universities building Second Life islands. And I think it's important to explore those and try those, like try those different experiences. I think augmented reality has some real potential for especially, you know, some of the skills jobs like mechanic and things like that. Imagine a mechanic that can walk up to a machine and virtually take it apart while having their hands on the machine for the first time, right? That's incredibly powerful. And so how do we make sure that we're using the technology in the right ways that really are helping learning and not getting distracted by the shiny objects? It's something we spend a lot of time talking about because especially with AI, we need to be sure we're solving human-driven problems. We know what the problems are. We know the challenges that students and teachers face. Let's solve those problems. Let's not try to look for new problems. Let's not try to, you know, be a hammer looking for a nail. We know what the challenges are. Let's make sure we stay focused and not get distracted by the technology. So from a takeaway standpoint, I think as you build an architecture, we talked a little bit about this early on. And this slide I actually dug up from an old Canvas slide deck from 6 years ago. And these are the foundations that Instructure built Canvas on. Simple, right? It was so simple to use that it didn't take a lot of technology knowledge to stand it up and turn it on. It didn't take a lot of training for educators to get in and use it or students to jump in and use it. It just worked the way it was supposed to. Engaging, right? Making sure that we're creating in this new technology enhanced learning phase, we're creating engaging paths, those abilities for students and teachers to engage. But students to engage with each other in powerful ways, right? We need to make sure that we don't lose that peer-to-peer engagement, that peer networking that is kind of an intrinsic part of the traditional classroom as you move to that technology-enhanced learning. Openness, and this is one of the things I think is most important. As you look at your ecosystem of solutions, the ability to choose solutions that are open, and don't just say they're open, but actually are open. I think that's one of the things that I fell in love with Canvas for the first time was the fact that we were open source, open LTIs, open APIs. We used LTIs met the most recent standard of LTIs. It's funny, if you come to my company, we keep our calendars open, right? Like anybody can see what anybody else is doing on a given day. That's really important because we need to make sure that these tools work together and that we empower educators and administrators to build the solutions that they want. And you can't do that without a level of openness. You can't get that data out of all those different tools and into a coherent format if we're not open. That's incredibly important. And then, you know, reliability is something that I think is really just we now take for granted. I think take a time machine back 10, 15 years ago, and we didn't see the reliability in these tools that we now see, right? Every time you did an update, every quarter, every 6 months, maybe sometimes monthly, you would have outages, things like that. we've actually trained ourselves now that with SaaS technology and with the reliability of the internet, our technology is live 99.99% of the time, right? We need to make sure that we continue to choose software that is that reliable, because it's become the norm. This is actually interesting. I think recentering higher ed on student learning is incredibly important. Colleges should place, this is actually from Stephen Mintz through a publication he did with EDUCAUSE. But colleges should place more students in learning communities with a thematic or pre-career focus, right? Making sure that we're mapping to those careers, incredibly important. Let's replace standard discipline specific gen ed courses with broader and more interdisciplinary courses. I think this is really important. I think we've the idea of a major, and I've watched my daughter go through this recently, this idea that I have to choose, am I a business major? Am I a communication major? Am I a humanities major? Like there's very strict paths. What we find is most jobs don't require the skills that are developed in those very strict paths. They require skills from across those. And so, you know, there's another side that, you know, showed a number of executives, and there, you know, there was an actor, there was the CEO of Disney, there was a university president. And they said, what are all these people have in common? They were all English majors, right? And the idea that like you're rarely does this very, very specific major map to the jobs you're going to do shows a little bit about that skills gap we talked about earlier, but it also shows, you know, we need to be flexible with how we're creating these programs. Department-based majors with integrated career pathways and complementary courses, we've talked about that. Active and experiential learning is a huge topic right now. How do we make sure that here's my proof that I have learned a skill, here's my proof that I've applied this skill, right? And usually that skill application will come in tandem with a potential employer or an organization that really understands the industry standards or the industry needs. That's incredibly important. And then those assessment methods, right? I love this. This is probably going to be hard for the translator, but the physical plus digital campus, he calls it the fidgetal campus. But I think this is interesting in making us understand that gap, like I talked about earlier, between distinctive online programs, distinctive on-campus programs. These are coming together in a way that needs to be seamless. And so I think this quote speaks to that incredibly well. Future campuses need to be less like limited access highways and more like mobility hubs. Places where students can easily switch from high speed to low speed academic progress, from cohort to individualized learning, and from express lanes to local educational paths that allow for a lot of stops and starts. That's incredibly compelling. And if you look back at that image I showed of the traditional model versus the future model of lifelong learning, I think that captures it so incredibly well. We need to make sure that we are facilitating learning at every level, not caught up in our own bureaucracy, creating those on-ramps for learners as they come back to the programs, making sure that we view all students as learners, not non-traditional or traditional, but learners. And how do we facilitate all of those? So one of the things that I encourage you to do, I mentioned earlier that Melissa Lobel and I actually host the InstructureCast podcast. We continue these conversations. We love talking about these themes and others, but we love your feedback as well. And so we'd love to have you join us and listen to that. And then the other aspect too is, Instructure, we hold our annual user group conference every year. Ours is coming up in July. And it is such a beyond Instructure as a company, obviously we sell software, but we have so many incredible partners that come together, share their experience. When I say partners, I mean customers and partner organizations, but share their experience and how they've solved the challenges. And I think one of the biggest things I love about education as well is this idea that we solve problems together. We come together and listen to each other's stories and find solutions that way. So thank you so much for your time. I know I talk quickly. I hope it wasn't too painful for the translator, but I've got a lot. I get excited about this. And so I spend a lot of time speaking to organizations and frankly, you know, I appreciate you having me and being able to discuss these challenges with you. Thank you.
Gracias, Ryan. Me quedo aquí, ¿verdad, Martita? En el canal de español, me escuchan todos.
Escuchamos perfecto, Pedro.
Ryan, gracias. Creo, me recordaste mucho estos proyectos de Horizon, que proyectábamos las tecnologías en el futuro y que marcábamos el corto, mediano y largo plazo. Y lo que tú nos presentas, estas 8 tendencias, la verdad es que las has enmarcado muy bien en un tiempo, pues, inmediato. Realmente debemos estar trabajando ya en estas, en nuestras instituciones. Y me parece una buena reflexión hacia dónde hay conectados en este momento de universidades públicas, privadas, que son directivos y que seguramente pues tendremos luces para seguir caminando hacia adelante con tu exposición. Me gustaría saber, antes de entrar a las preguntas, porque ya debe de haber comentarios, Martita, a la foto, sé también que Moisés, ya sé, el director de CUDICE ya se sumó, también bienvenido Moisés, y pudiéramos hacer la foto antes de que se me olvide y se desconecten Martita, y ya vayan levantando la mano para escuchar si ustedes hacen su participación en español y Eleazar, que es el traductor, pueda hacérsela a Ryan y así viceversa según el canal donde estemos. Martita.
Claro que
No.
sí. Recordamos que para hacer sus preguntas pueden levantar la mano como lo está haciendo Laura Elena Díaz y
Ahora.
nosotros habilitamos su micrófono. También vamos pidiendo apoyo para que abran su video y poder tomar la foto. Laura, por favor, si quieres iniciar con las preguntas.
Buenas tardes, quisiera saber ¿cuál es la opinión sobre las clases aceleradas o cuál es la experiencia que tiene el instructor? Muchas gracias.
Yeah, I mean,
Aceleradas.
honestly, I think we'll move more. Accelerated classes are one example of personalized learning, right? Understanding that a student is moving faster than the rate of their courses. And so, frankly, I think if you're measuring the assessment of a student, the mastery of skill, we'll move to a future where students are not following a traditional, 12 years of primary education and then 4 to 8 years of secondary education, but following a personalized learning path through all of that. I think it's funny, we all carry the world's knowledge in we carry the world's knowledge in our pocket with cell phones, and yet we still need educators every day to guide us through those learning journeys and to help us. And so I think the accelerated classes, the ability to create personalized pathways, you'll see much more prolific in the future. And I think Martin had a conversation or had a.
Martita, ¿quién más tenemos?
Sí, el doctor Moisés Torres tiene una pregunta. Vamos a habilitar el micrófono. Listo.
Gracias, Marta. First and foremost, thank you, Ryan, for such a enlightening talk. I think you covered very interesting issues regarding this topic. But I do have a question for you. You talked about the uses of AI within the student population. And what do you consider are some of the, how to address some of these ethical issues with students to ensure that we know that they are doing the work, they are doing the thinking, and not letting ChatGPT be the driving force of their thinking and the development of their critical thinking?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I actually, as a writer, as someone that learned that I enjoyed writing and was good at writing later in my schooling, probably not until I was in college, I worry that my kids won't develop that love of writing because they're not doing it in the same way. So that's valid. But I think when we go back to that conversation around assessment, I think that's the biggest challenge is we can't just assign a 20-page paper anymore, and then, you just can't prove that a student that a student used ChatGPT as part of that process, or used it, you know, even within the boundaries of that you set for them. But what you can do is kind of flip that on its head. And we've seen schools, educators go in and say, okay, we're going to use ChatGPT to write this for us. And then we're going to print it out. And I want you to dissect it. And I want you to delve into it. I want you to figure out where it was challenged. Because, you know, like it or not, AI has bias. If you ask most AI tools for a photo of a CEO, they will pick a white male. So that bias, the gender and racial bias exists within the data that that model is trained on, and it's perpetuating that. So we can actually start, there's a study that came out last week that started looking at words that for some reason AI tools respond to. In English, the word delve is not one that we use, you know, delve into something. We don't use that very often, but for some reason, AI models seem to like it, right? So there's these that they're using that you know, to play kind of cat and mouse with these tools. But ultimately, I think it's how we assess knowledge. We've got to make sure that, and I've talked to, from the very first podcast I did, or a webinar I did in January of 22 on AI, I had an educator say, we're going to go medieval on them, right? We're going back to paper and pencil, and that's how we're going to do everything. And I don't think that's the answer. I think because the bottom line is, these students are going to graduate and go on to jobs, and they'll be using AI as part of the process. And so really it's more, we need to move away from that gotcha idea of I caught you cheating to here's how you use it productively and show them the benefits. I think one of the other things that came out of an early podcast was a professor who had a neurodivergent son. His son had autism. And he said, my son has a really hard time doing an assignment if he doesn't understand the why behind the assignment. And it's one of those things where we often as educators skip the why. We give an assignment without fully articulating what the benefit is. And I think when we explain the why to students, the job isn't to go write this using ChatGPT. The job is to write this so that you are better than ChatGPT, so that you can write these tools. And you know what, then let's run it through ChatGPT. And did that make it better? How did it make it better? What did it change to make it better? Let's dissect it that way. So there's different models to approach it, but it's going to be a continuing evolving process because AI is getting smarter and smarter. You know, we just need to find ways to make sure that we're engaging with students, explaining the why, and then running assessment completely differently than we have in the past.
Great.
Great question. Thank you.
No, thank you very much.
Bueno, les recordamos que también pueden dejar sus preguntas en el chat, en lo que se animan. ¿Quién más? Si quiere hacer la pregunta en vivo. Vamos a compartir la pregunta de Martín González. En realidad son dos. La primera es que si has dado clases. Y la segunda es que le gustaría conocer tu punto de vista, tu opinión acerca de la escuela en casa.
Yep. I've been an adjunct professor at the University of Utah. I've also, I actually spent a lot of time working with first through sixth graders in summer school programs when I was in college. So I've taught throughout my career. It's probably how I ended up in this role. But the interesting thing, you know, for homeschool programs, I think I'm personally a proponent of that personalized learning path, as we talked about earlier. And I don't think homeschool is anything more than a kind of self-guided or a parent-guided personalized learning path. I do, however, think that there are things that we want our students, some standards. We hold our schools to standards on the outcomes that our students achieved. And we need to make sure that those same standards are being met within a homeschool environment. But I think one of the reasons that homeschool has grown in popularity is because students are being held back, or their students are being viewed as they're more advanced and they're progressing more quickly than their school. And it's a valid point. You know, my daughter is very smart. And so there were times when she was probably moving faster than the curriculum was there. So I do think, you know, my only concern is when we, you know, in the U.S. we have a problem with homeschooling, and I think political bias, religious bias really becoming dominant within that. If you're being homeschooled, you need to make sure we're still seeing those required student outcomes that we would if with any other school.
Muchísimas gracias. Si alguien más quiere hacer algún comentario, alguna otra pregunta, por favor, estamos ya en el tiempo límite, en lo que se animan a, si damos un minutito para tomar la foto, por favor, si nos ayudan habilitando su video, veo que ya lo habilitaron la mayoría, no tardamos mucho. Muchas gracias por su colaboración, por acompañarnos y estar aquí con nosotros en esta sesión. Les voy a contar una, dos, tres, sonreímos. Listo, adelante Pedro, muchas
nuestra
gracias.
Mejor sonrisa. Pues si no hay más participaciones, nos dejas, Ryan, una reflexión de estas tendencias. Me gustó esta palabra, yo me dedico a la evaluación, a la calidad del aprendizaje utilizando tecnologías educativas. Y nos has dado también hechos concretos en dónde centrarnos en poder validar, pues utilizando la inteligencia artificial y no tenerle miedo. Aquí está Mari Carmen de Urquijo, que he trabajado mucho con ella en la Salle, y era como igual cuando tratábamos de convencer, vámonos a utilizar la educación a distancia. También está Lucero Cavazos. ¿Cuánto tiempo nos llevamos en ese proceso? Y hoy, igual, ¿no, Ryan? Tenemos que estar abiertos a todas estas tecnologías y no tenerles miedo, al contrario, cómo involucrarlas en los procesos, como Mari Carmen, yo he aprendido mucho de ella en el sentido como pedagoga, ¿no? Cómo la parte pedagógica tiene que estar involucrada con las tecnologías, y tenemos que ser nosotros los actores, nosotros profesores, nosotros directivos, nosotros responsables, de cómo siempre estar en esta conexión de que nuestros estudiantes pues son inquietos y absorben más estas tecnologías. No hay nadie más, ¿verdad, Martita? Pues agradecerles todo. Por ahí Karina les va a dejar una liga de un cuestionario que quiere aplicar a CERTA. Entonces, si lo montas, Cari, y si quien tenga tiempo le da link y lo puede contestar.
Sí, muchas gracias.
Lo ayudaría,
Se los voy a
nos
poner aquí
ayudaría
en el chat.
A que ellos tengan datos y reflexiones de utilidad para estos fines académicos. Ryan, I appreciate your time. Welcome to Mexico en Chihuahua en October. Es the conference annual for the ANUYES, de todas las the universities of Mexico, public and private. Esperamos que vengas a comer unos taquitos, ¿ok?
I would like to. I look forward to it. Thank you.
Cari, montas la liga para quienes puedan contestarte.
Listo. Ya la puse en el chat.
Ya la puso Cari en el chat. Les agradeceríamos y la apoyamos en que le demos respuestas si tienen unos minutitos. Y agradecer a Cudi, también a Moisés Torres, que es el directivo que se conectó con nosotros. Y estaremos, recuerden que todo este material estará en un repositorio, la sesión, esta grabación, que seguramente será útil para nosotros, para nuestros estudiantes también. Muchas gracias y muy buenas tardes. Gracias, Ryan.
Gracias.
Gracias, bye.
CUDI, la Red Nacional de Educación e Investigación Mexicana, busca impulsar el desarrollo de aplicaciones que utilicen esta red, fomentando la colaboración en proyectos de investigación y educación entre sus miembros.
Para contar con servicios de telecomunicaciones apropiados a las necesidades de la investigación y educación superior, alrededor de 130 países en el mundo han implementado redes nacionales de educación e investigación llamadas RENEI.
Estas redes son asociaciones civiles sin fines de lucro, abiertas a cualquier institución educativa o centro de investigación, para obtener economías de escala en la conectividad. Solamente hay una red por país. Las redes nacionales de educación e investigación de todo el mundo intercambian tráfico gratuitamente entre sí, Con ello, han creado una infraestructura global indispensable para la investigación multinacional colaborativa. Las RENEI son controladas por sus beneficiarios, las instituciones de educación superior y centros de investigación. CUDI proporciona a su membresía servicios de conectividad, multimedia, capacitación, aplicaciones, acceso a fondos de financiamiento y colaboración.
La red CUDI proporciona conectividad hacia las redes nacionales de educación e investigación de todo el mundo para proyectos colaborativos. Busca consolidar proyectos de infraestructura urbana de red y facilitar la participación de su membresía en puntos de intercambio de tráfico de Internet. También tiene convenios con proveedores para compartir infraestructura en beneficio de su membresía.
CUDI busca desplegar servicios sobre la red que apoyen a la transformación digital de su membresía. Muchos de estos servicios han sido desarrollados por la comunidad académica, miembros de las redes avanzadas, compartiendo su uso sin fin de lucro. EduRoam es un servicio mundial de movilidad segura que permite a estudiantes, investigadores, académicos y administrativos tener acceso a Internet en sus campus y en las instituciones que visitan, con su mismo nombre de usuario y contraseña institucional. A través de CUDI, México tiene más de 550 puntos de acceso implementados.
Fénix, la Federación de Identidades Mexicana, da acceso a la comunidad universitaria a través de un único nombre de usuario y contraseña a servicios federados, implementados por CUDI y por las redes nacionales de educación e investigación en Latinoamérica, Europa y el resto del mundo. CECIRT, el equipo de respuesta a incidentes de seguridad de CUDI, pone a disposición de la membresía cursos sobre seguridad informática, implementa herramientas para la gestión de incidentes, apoya en la implementación del CECIRT en las instituciones asociadas y su mejora continua, además de un portal web a través del cual se tiene contacto directo con los CECIRT de las instituciones socias de las redes avanzadas.
BC CUDI. CUDI cuenta con licencias de Zoom disponibles para compartir con su membresía, con capacidad de hasta 300 usuarios por sesión. Grabaciones en la nube y locales, conexiones a equipos de videoconferencia y dispositivos móviles, además de la posibilidad de conectar con varias redes sociales para transmisiones en vivo.
La RENEI mexicana también apoya a su membresía en la coordinación y difusión de eventos virtuales en tiempo real con apoyo de la plataforma de videoconferencia.
Google Workspace for Education. La RENIE pone a disposición de profesores y estudiantes de sus instituciones socias cuentas de correo ilimitadas con Google Workspace for Education para generar oportunidades de aprendizaje y agilizar las tareas administrativas.
Repositorios digitales. CUDI, a través de la comunidad REMERI, la Red Mexicana de Repositorios Institucionales, busca apoyar a su membresía en la configuración, implementación y seguimiento de sus repositorios. REMERI es una iniciativa de repositorios de acceso abierto en la que participan 69 instituciones mexicanas con 122 repositorios que, gracias a estándares comunes, permiten a través de buscadores ser accesados en un portal común. A la fecha, se tienen 466 mil documentos cosechados. Moodle SaaS. CUDI pone a disposición el Software as a Service en la nube de Cedia, sobre el cual se ejecuta el software open source LMS Moodle, permitiendo a las instituciones socias disminuir gastos de inversión y tiempos de implementación, tarifas competitivas en relación a los principales proveedores, soporte técnico personalizado y experimentado.
Grupos técnicos y comunidades. CUDI te invita a sumarte y ser parte activa de los grupos de trabajo y comunidades CUDI, con temáticas como capacitación, cómputo en la nube, federación, gobierno de TI, IPv6,
redes definidas por software, Delta Metropolitana, servicios de acceso emergentes, seguridad,
videoconferencia, arte, ciencia y cultura, multicast,
astronomía, ciencias de la tierra, CIMAR GUM,
estudios socioambientales, inteligencia artificial, interacción humano-computadora,
Red LATMX, física de altas energías,
REMERI, supercómputo, y salud. Divulgación. La RENEI mexicana comparte con su comunidad información de los eventos y actividades de sus instituciones miembros. Para ello, pone a su disposición el Boletín CUDI, que cuenta con más de 5,000 cuentas de correos activos, su plataforma de colaboración, el portal CUDI y sus redes sociales. Publicaciones. CUDI es reconocida como editor por el Instituto Nacional del Derecho de Autor, INDAUTOR, y puede registrar publicaciones con código ISBN para su membresía.
NOC CUDI, el centro de operaciones de la red, brinda servicios de atención, monitoreo, detección y solución de fallas para los enlaces de la red CUDI. Otorga asesorías para configuraciones de sistemas de monitoreo y enlaces independientes a la RENEI mexicana.
Gestión de proyectos. CUDI ofrece a su membresía asistencia en la formulación de proyectos, brindando asesoría para la conformación del plan inicial, así como en la exploración y sugerencia de fuentes de financiamiento para su desarrollo. De igual forma, ofrece apoyo en la difusión y divulgación de los resultados obtenidos por él mismo.
Servicios sobre la infraestructura de Red Clara. A través de convenios internacionales, CUDI pone a disposición de su comunidad herramientas de colaboración desarrolladas por Red Clara y otras RENEI asociadas.
Envío. Herramienta para enviar archivos pesados. Fondos y socios. Identifica oportunidades de financiamiento e interesados en trabajar conjuntamente las temáticas de preferencia del usuario. BC Expreso. Es el servicio de videoconferencia de escritorio para usuarios CUDI. HPC. Red Clara, en colaboración con Scalac, el servicio de cómputo avanzado desde y para América Latina y el Caribe, integra el acceso y uso a instituciones de educación superior miembros de CUDI a través de su infraestructura de red de servicios de cómputo en la región.
La Escuela Regional de Redes promueve la capacitación, el desarrollo profesional y la difusión de conocimientos en tecnologías de la comunicación entre instituciones miembros CUDI. Promociona actividades de formación conjuntamente con otras redes nacionales de la región.
Sé parte de la Red Nacional de Educación e Investigación CUDI.